Welcome to Listen Up. Today we're continuing part two of our series of interviews and opinions related to prisons, prisoners, and recently released folks. The following is an interview conducted by Norman Keeling with Leo Hilton, an inmate at the Maine State Prison.
My name is Norman Keeling. I was sentenced to 44 years in prison in 1989. I did approximately 30 years inside. I have conducted a series of interviews with residents inside. This interview was conducted by phone, and you'll hear lots of sounds in the background, prison sounds.
I've been incarcerated in Maine State Prison now for 11 and a half years. I've been incarcerated total for 13. I turned 31 this year. I was arrested when I was 18. I had just turned 18 5 weeks prior. That was in the wake of my biological father's death on the one-year anniversary of my foster mother's death. That was March 19th. And with those successive deaths was a buildup of trauma that I did not know how to handle. You know, I grew up in an emotionally impoverished environment where I never developed the language or the ability to articulate emotion. Growing up in the abusive household that I did, we were allowed to be content, happy, or briefly sad. But that was about it. We needed to be content and accepting of whatever came our way. So my father, he saw himself as a holy man who was raising warrior sons in a society that was designed to kill us. So with that worldview, with that perspective, came a level of training for violence and conditioning. And then at age 10, I had had enough, ran away so much that my mother feared for my life. You know, I was becoming more and more reckless in my attempts to get away, and the police were continually picking me up and taking me home. Right back to that same abusive situation. And I had enough, and my mother didn't know really what was going on because she was too busy working, trying to keep food on the table and my dad's medical needs taken care of. When I turned 18 and had all of this built-up trauma that I didn't know how to deal with, how to articulate or how to seek help for, I found myself in a position where I feared losing what family I had left. So my foster brother had committed a burglary the year prior. Safe was in his apartment, and I let his victim into his apartment, and they found the safe there. So I had that guilt weighing on me when this same foster brother was facing prison time and didn't have the money for a lawyer, so I needed to save him. So that fear of losing him led me to that place of desperation where it sounded like a great idea to go back and rob that same house. And I was so prideful as to think that I could control every variable, where no one would get hurt, where we could get the money that we needed for him to get a lawyer that would get him either significantly less prison time or avoid it altogether. Again, that pride and that faulty thinking of, you know, believing that I could control things. And in reality, what others could see in me, I couldn't see in myself, which was that I couldn't even control myself. I was spiraling. I didn't know how to deal with the emotions that I was, or that were building up in me. And so I was covering all of them with smoking and drinking and partying and just living that fast life. Anything that would numb or distract me from dealing with the deeper, harder things that I wasn't equipped to deal with. So fast forward, and you know, I put myself in a horrible situation, made a series of decisions and plans that led me to the front door of a home, and the alarm went off and my mind broke. And instead of doing what any 18-year-old kid would do, in fear and run away, that fear triggered in me that violent training of my youth, and I ran forward and nearly killed two people, two innocent people, and didn't get a dollar, didn't get a dime, and ran away and traumatized that family and their whole community, victimized my own family, and everyone who had to be witness to the aftermath. And, you know, so that's something that it took me a long time to reconcile with, to accept my guilt. So when I got here, I was wrapped up in telling lies about my level of culpability, because in county I learned that the evidence didn't point to me. So out of fear, I told any story that I could that would line up with the evidence that didn't place me there. And I told those lies so often that I started to believe them. And it took me years, 5 years actually, to get to the point where I was able to be honest with myself and with God and really acknowledge the level of my guilt and start seeking forgiveness from my family and from anyone else who was still in my life, where I acknowledged and confessed, you know, that I've been lying to them for years and seeking their forgiveness for the harm that I caused them. You know, so that came from the intervention of who has now became my mentor and best friend and spiritual father, who introduced me to the Jesus Christ of the Bible, where, you know, I grew up seeing the hypocrisy in the church and hypocrisy in professed Christians, where it kept me away from Christ for so long. You know, this hardened combat veteran, he showed me that I wasn't as tough as I thought I was. I wasn't as hard as I thought I was. I wasn't as smart or wise or worldly as I thought I was. And he really helped me grow up, you know, from getting into the fights and doing the time in SAG and getting extracted and getting involved in every type of hustle that there is here that breaks just about every rule that exists. And that was the beginning of my transformation, mind, body, and soul, from the scared, broken, wannabe thug kid who went in and caused such harm in community, to start growing into the man that God is transforming me into, which is a man of godly integrity, truth, and character. So along my journey, I was able to be a barber. I still am. And a mentor, tutor, you know, tutoring just about every subject that we have, but I specialize in math. Started tutoring my fellow college students when I was working on my undergrad, my associate's degree and bachelor's degrees in liberal arts. Became a peer facilitator of programs, cognitive behavioral therapy based thinking for a change to restorative and transformative justice. I started serving in hospice in 2014, where previously I thought that avenue of service was completely closed to me. In high school, I started and almost completed the CNA training, Certified Nurses Assistant, in my junior year of high school. Being young and in foster care and not able to actually work in the field, started having too much fun outside of class, and ended up getting me kicked out because I wasn't getting the hours that I needed in the classroom. So I thought that was close to me. But when Candace Powell came in, and where I finally met Candace, she started giving me those gentle invitations to be more than who I was and learn compassion and love and care. And other men in the program saw me and saw my interactions with a couple of my dear friends who were actively dying along the way. And I was able to go down and help provide care for them and be there for them in their last days. That really started reaching a deeper part of me that I had deliberately and systematically killed off from the ages of 12 on. It was just a process of deadening. After I committed my crime and throughout the process of being in county, it was just cutting off, closing off different parts of my heart. It got to the point where I was very, very callous. I was callous-hearted and blind, and I thought that a lot of those emotions and that compassion was gone. So thankfully, through hospice, I was able to reconnect with those deeper parts of myself. So that led into later on, I was able to go through the certification course to become a certified recovery coach. And I'm currently serving as the NAACP executive secretary. And all of these programs and efforts, and it's really helped form the man that I am and open up avenues of greater service for my fellow incarcerated people. But it's also hugely beneficial to me personally, because through service and through connecting with people, I'm able to see and learn more of myself. And all of that, after I graduated with my bachelor's degree, I started pursuing a master's. I wanted to get a master's in social work because I wanted to be the hero in everybody's life. I wanted to be a reentry caseworker and help people overcome all of the obstacles that exist for people getting out of prison. And then I realized along the way that God's vision was bigger than mine, that rather than helping each individual person, where he has ordered my steps is to work towards demolishing the obstacles that exist. So I don't get to be the hero in everybody's life. I get to be a part of the solution to help everybody. And that was a huge revelation for me that led me to George Mason University and their Jimmy and Rosalind Carter School for Peace and Conflict Resolution. And I just started my second year of the master's program in conflict analysis and resolution with an individualized concentration, mostly in social justice advocacy and activism. And that has been a world-opening experience for me, where the connections that I'm making and the relationships that I'm making with my fellow classmates and professors, and how that has opened doors to other amazing people around the country and around the world, overseas even, you know, people who want to encourage me in the work that I'm doing and help and support and join efforts. And it's been an amazing experience where that education has helped inform the different aspects of my service here. I serve on a few different advisory boards. One of them is the Prison Education Partnership between the University of Maine at Augusta and the Maine Department of Corrections, looking to expand educational services and look at practice and improve and grow, because we all know that education is an evidence-based practice that reduces recidivism. And we have an administration who understands that, which is amazing. To see the support that we have through this process and seeing the expansions and the improvements and being a part of it is very encouraging, because, like you know, we've been waiting a very, very long time to see even a little bit of progress, and it's finally here, and being a part of it is a blessing. So in addition to that board, I'm also on the Resident Advisory Council, which acts as a bridge, a communication bridge, between the resident population and the administration. It includes everyone from the warden to case managers, unit managers, security staff, and residents who are in different leadership positions, leaders of different civic groups and different avenues of service within this community, where we are representative of the general population, and people know that they can come to us with issues that are going on, and we can present them directly to the administration and to the people who are in positions to affect change in the areas that need change. And there's a subcommittee from that Resident Advisory Council dealing specifically with medical issues, because also, as you know, dealing with medical has been a horrible experience for a very long time. There have been amazing nurses and nurse practitioners, but the structure and the delivery of services has been terrible for a very long time. And again, you know, we now have administration there too who wants to improve the services. You know, so we're working together towards that as well. There's also the SECP policy work group. So in this latest, in the 130th session of the legislature, we were able to get LD-1593 passed, which dealt specifically with home confinement, or the Supervised Community Confinement Program. And that has led to this work group where it is participatory governance in practice, where resident voices have been at the forefront of guiding this rewriting of the home confinement policy to make it more supportive and evidence-based and to incorporate the new statutory language that was introduced by that bill. The people who are in positions to actually enact this policy, they've been involved and encouraging this process. So they've been involved and encouraging this process. Working on that policy work group has been an incredible experience too, and is a testament to what is possible when you have people in positions who are willing to understand and realize and put into practice the need for collaboration, right? The tearing down of this belief that incarcerated people are no longer people and no longer capable of participating in anything good. So that's been great. Also been working on the NAACP policy committee, working to influence public policy change, and my monthly column for the publication Mainer called Shining Light on Humanity. That's the foundation, showing the need and the presence of humanity in prison and the power of people coming in who believe in the possibility of change. And Candace Powell, I mentioned her earlier, she's one of those people through hospice. She is the executive director of Maine Hospice Council, and she just dedicated so many years to realizing change in this environment and bringing in the hospice program and showing grown, hardened men that it is okay to be compassionate and caring and to learn to forgive ourselves, learn to forgive others, learn to love others, learn to love ourselves. And she was a huge and instrumental piece in that. Catherine Matlack as well, with Humankinder. She came in to one of our hospice meetings, actually a few of them, along the same lines, just a very caring, compassionate human being. And that compassion extended even through COVID, and you know, where she hasn't been able to come in. And she reached back in with Norm and Humankinder and has helped support my education. If it wasn't for their financial support, I may have had to take a semester or two off from school, and that would have set me back so far. But because of that care and that compassion, that support, I'm able to keep going. The dog program, right? We've got three of them here. America's Vet Dogs, the Canine Corrections Program, and now the Little Angels Service Dogs. That's the latest program, and that brings out so much gentleness in men, where you see these big guys who spend their lives being tough and not showing emotion, just get giddy and playful with these puppies. It's amazing to see and to partake in myself, you know, and that's a huge piece of it too. With Pope Memorial Humane Society is the organization who continues to provide training and rescue dogs to come in through the Canine Corrections Program, training us to train dogs and make them more adoptable and help them overcome whatever traumas that they have been through, and through helping them overcome their trauma actually helps us overcome our trauma, because trauma is almost universal, if not totally universal, in human experience, and especially in the experience of incarceration. And COVID has been an additional trauma on top of everything else. My personal experience in SAG and isolation and that feeling of isolation and loneliness over the course of my life had me prepared, oddly enough, uniquely prepared for COVID and the isolation and the lockdowns that came, where I was able to help people with their mental health and with establishing structure in their day because of my experience in SEG and needing to do that and all the scars that I still wear internally from my time in SEG came to use here. But I actually had to fight against that of becoming completely introverted and shut off and antisocial, because that is one of those tendencies that persist. Even these, it's been 10 years since I've been in SEG, but as soon as I know we're going to be locked down, that I have that trigger. I have that mental and physical and emotional SEG mentality and SEG schedule and SEG way of being. I need to fight against that in order to hold on to the humanity and the compassion and everything that I've gained over the years. Still, that those scars are still there. And, those are things that a lot of people don't see. But, so COVID has been horrible on a lot of people. Mental health issues have been exacerbated. You see the wear and tear on staff, on administrators, on the resident population. In every corner of this place, it's been horrible. You know, family deaths, deaths of friends, the explosion of overdoses, just one trauma after another, just has been building up. It's been rough. In addition to those other areas of service, I'm also on the Restorative Practices Steering Committee and working towards bringing restorative justice practices and principles into this system. And again, working hand in hand with administration and staff towards this goal of implementing change, real substantive systemic change, and looking at the Norway system and adopting the principle of normality, realizing that the system that has been in place is not the system that should be. That incarceration should lead to rehabilitation and transformation. And in order to attain that goal, life on the inside needs to mirror life on the outside as much as possible without compromising safety and security. That's what the principle of normality says, and that's what we're looking to shift, finally shift this culture towards. Also towards that end, I've been on the Transitioning Justice Lab through the Carter School, and a subsection of that is the Carceral Society section, where we are looking to raise awareness of the universal impact of mass incarceration, carceral spaces, even for people who are not, who don't see their direct connection. And that's where really AIM and HIT, Artivism in Maine, and helping incarcerated individuals transition. These efforts that are being led by incarcerated and formerly incarcerated voices is huge. They see the need to build a bridge from the inside to the outside, right? You know, we've had these efforts going on in pockets in different areas of society and different areas of the prison system, but there has never been a cohesive, collaborative effort to really provide support for people coming out. You know, then that's been huge. MPRN too, Maine Prisoner Reentry Network, with Bruce Nodden and all the work that he's been doing. Again, with incarcerated and formerly incarcerated voices leading the way, and that's what sets apart these efforts from so many others that have come in the past. Like this Freedom in Captivity project I was able to be a part of. It was orchestrated by Colby College's Dr. Catherine Bestman. I was able to submit poems and do readings for them. For the ABCs of Abolition, I was able to read words and come up with my own phrases to go with them. I was also featured with community leaders on the episode 8 of their podcast, which is called Finding Our Courage, Alternatives to Incarceration for Addressing Harm. That's going to be released on October 18th. But it's these efforts that, you know, people from the outside, it's that compassion and that caring and that humanity that fosters transformation, it fosters rehabilitation, and it fosters more humanity and compassion within us as we continue to work towards bettering ourselves. And, you know, those of us who have committed the greatest harm in community are some of the most committed people to introducing healing and restoration in our communities. And that's where, again, helping incarcerated individuals transition and artivism in Maine, you know, we're collaborating towards the creation of a tomorrow that actually supports incarcerated people in our efforts to reintegrate into a society that we no longer know, right? We come in and we're supposed to pay our debt to society when in reality, society is paying our debt to society until we have an opportunity to participate in community efforts towards change and transformation and healing and restoration. We're also working towards shifting the societal narrative around carceral spaces and incarcerated individuals so that people can see the humanity that exists within us and grow this movement, bring more people to want to join our efforts, right? Because it is only through supporting returning citizens that we will be able to make real strides towards reducing recidivism. People, I can't wait for the day when everyone understands that our goal is the same. Regardless of race, color, creed, or political affiliation, our goal is the same. We all want safer communities in Maine. It's just the methods that we want to take and that we get caught up on the division there. That's what prevents forward movement. So if we can take that step back and connect on that goal, that same goal, then we might finally be able to start making some real progress, even greater than what we're making right now.
Wow. That blows me away. What an amazing story. In short, you're doing a lot of work in there, and you're helping a lot of people. And yes, hit and aim, we're out here, and we're an extension of the inside. We work with people like Leo, and when people are ready, they're doing the work in there. We know they're doing the work in there. We want to help them when they come out. We want to help them find housing, jobs, and we just want to assist them in being successful out here. There's a lot going on in there, and this rehabilitation is huge. I believe a lot of it has to do with habilitation, learning that the things you don't know. Once they learn what they're doing wrong, they learn to address the issue, and then they move forward. Either they make the changes or they don't, and that's the difference between Leo, myself, and some other people. There's some of us that really care about what's going on in the system, how it works, how we move forward from here. And it's people like Leo that are making the difference in there. Their hours and their commitment in there is unchallenged. It's unparalleled to many people doing time. These guys are making change. You can see what they're doing. Leo, thank you so very much. I look forward to talking to you again. Maybe we can do another piece with you.
That would be great. Thank you, Norm.
Leo, we'll talk later, brother. I love you, and I love what you're doing, man. Keep it up.
I love you, too. Thank you for all your work, brother.
All right, we'll talk soon, bro.
All right.
Bye.
You've been listening to Leo Hilton, an inmate at the Maine State Prison, describing the reasons he wound up in prison and his life there, and then about the various activities he's involved with and the movements to help people in prison, and the recently released. He was speaking to Norman Keeling, who is the head of a group called HIT, standing for Helping Incarcerated Individuals Transition. The show is Listen Up. My name is Vic Treadwell. I'm the producer of this series, as well as WBFY's station manager. We'll be hearing more in the series about incarcerated individuals and programs to help them on their release on later editions of Listen Up. I'd like to thank Norman Keeling of the Helping Incarcerated Individuals Transition program and Lorraine Brown of the Artivism in Maine program for bringing this to the station and for their help in producing this series.